were doing them in places like Buffalo, Chicago, and no New Yorkers ever saw them, and therefore you don't exist. So there was Shakespeare Heaven, Son of Shakespeare Heaven, Bride of Shakespeare Heaven, and then maybe my favorite strange work, which was from Venus and Adonis, the poem, turning it into a drama, if you could say, it was Venus and Adonis or The Open Road.
Gordon Rogoff and The Future of the Theater, tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Dreher. Key Republican senators say they expect to reach a compromise with the White House over questioning suspected terrorists. The president supports legislation that would let interrogators use more aggressive tactics on detainees than the Geneva Conventions permit, but leading GOP lawmakers have balked. They've proposed another law that would give detainees more protection than the president's plan. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham says the U.S. must treat suspects well, or U.S. troops could be at risk if they're captured.
Taliban and Al-Qaeda have no respect for anything or anybody, but that's not the only enemy we'll be facing. I can give you plenty of examples as a military lawyer where the Geneva Convention protected downed airmen and others people captured in the hands of foreign nations.
It's not clear how a compromise between the White House and Republicans would play out. Pope Benedict XVI expressed regrets today that his recent remarks about Islam were seen as offensive by Muslim faithful, but he stopped short of issuing an apology, and his statement did not put a stop to the wave of anger sweeping the Muslim world. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports from Rome.
Benedict said in his speech Tuesday in his native Germany, he cited a medieval text that did not reflect his personal opinion. The quote was a 14th century Christian description of Islam as evil and inhuman. He said, "I hope this serves to appease hearts and clarify the true meaning of my speech, which was an invitation to a frank and sincere dialogue with great mutual respect." Muslim reactions were mixed. Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood first said it was a sufficient apology, but later said it does not rise to the level of a clear apology. In Turkey, the foreign minister said the Pope is still expected to visit in November. But in Iran, there were many anti-Pope demonstrations. And the Vatican spokesman said the shooting of an Italian nun in Somalia could be related to the uproar. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
At least two dozen people were killed and more than 70 wounded after coordinated vehicle bombs rocked the disputed Iraqi city of Kirkuk today. NPR's Ann Garrels has more from the Iraqi capital.
Within hours, a truck rigged with explosives and four car bombs hit a range of targets, including Kurdish political parties, police, and a U.S. military patrol. There was massive damage. The head of the Kirkuk police said these unusually well-planned attacks were meant to fan sectarian violence. The fate of Kirkuk, which is claimed by both Kurds and Arabs, is one of the most potentially explosive issues facing the new Iraq. This region contains almost half of Iraq's oil. Its status is to be put to a constitutionally mandated referendum by the end of next year. The Kurds want to make Kirkuk, with its oil riches, their regional capital. In a recent move that may well have fueled tensions, the Kurdish government issued a draft law implying it has the right now to begin oil production in Kirkuk ahead of a referendum. Ann Garrels, NPR News, Baghdad.
This is NPR News. Five basketball players from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh were shot this morning in what police are calling a random act of violence. Three players were hospitalized. Police say they're still searching for the shooter and anyone else who may have been involved. Four of the basketball players had just started school this month. Some of the players were returning to their dormitory after a campus party before the shooting. The university says it's cooperating with police and its investigation. The Food and Drug Administration says a second produce company will recall products related to an outbreak of a deadly strain of E. coli. Salinas, California-based River Ranch Farms distributes spinach in bagged salad mixes. John Sepulvedo of member station KAZU reports from Monterey.
According to the FDA, River Ranch distributed salad mixed with spinach from Natural Selection Foods. The FDA did not say River Ranch is the source of the outbreak and is still focusing on Natural Selection Foods, which issued a voluntary recall late last week. River Ranch sells salads under the brand names Farmer's Market, Hy-Vee, and Fresh and Easy. River Ranch has not returned calls for comment. In a statement posted on their website on Friday, the company said it had not been contacted by the FDA, but the FDA now says River Ranch will issue a voluntary recall. FDA officials say they are looking at irrigation practices in the Salinas Valley. 9 outbreaks of the deadly E. coli strain have been traced back to the valley in the past 10 years. For NPR News, I'm John Sepulvedo in Monterey.
Mexicans along their country's western coast are cleaning up after Hurricane Lane came ashore this weekend. The hurricane downgraded to a tropical depression, but it still caused damage to power lines and homes and caused mudslides. I'm Dan Dreher, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces John Burnett's candid book that chronicles his reporting for NPR from the front lines. Uncivilized Beasts and Shameless Hellions is available at npr.org.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture and panel discussion presented by the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center at Boston University. First, speaking on his work and career is distinguished theater critic Gordon Rogoff. Following Mr. Rogoff's lecture will be a panel discussion on the future of the theater. Panelists include actor and narrator Will Lyman, Boston University School of Theater Assistant Professor Paula Langton, Huntington Theater Company Executive Director Michael Masso, American Repertory Theater Company Executive Director Rob Orchard, actress, director, and writer Paula Plum, and Boston Playwrights Theater Artistic Director Kate Snodgrass. Moderating the discussion is School of Theater Director Professor Jim Petosa. We begin with an introduction by Managing Director of the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center, Vita Palladino.
We are very happy tonight to have Gordon Rogoff. And the reason to have this program is to have an exhibition of Gordon's work, which demonstrates many facets of the world of theater. To be a critic, to be an actor, to be a director, to be a writer, a producer, and just dream. He dreams in theater all the time. Tonight, the format will be Gordon will get up and tell us about his work and his life and career, and that will be followed by a panel discussion about the future of theater with our Jim Petosa as the moderator. Gordon Rogoff has had a distinguished career in the field of drama and criticism that continues to this day. In his early career, he was co-founder and editor of Encore magazine in London, administrative director of the Actors Studio in New York, and was a dramaturg with the Open Theater in the 1960s. Over the years, the word of his skill spread through the theater world and called upon him to direct countless plays across the country and resulted in him receiving an Obie Award for his direction of Morton Lichter's Old Timers Sexual Symphony in 1976. His talents in the field of criticism and writing has led to prestigious posts at some of the country's finest universities and brought him many impressive awards. To name a few, he has been the recipient of the George G. Nathan Award for articles published in the Village Voice, the Morton Dorwin Zabel Award of the Academy of Arts and Letters, the Guggenheim Fellowship. In addition to the Village Voice, his writings have appeared in American Theater, Theater, Parnassus, and the New Republic, among others. He is the author of Theater is Not Safe, Theater Criticism, 1962 to 1986, and Vanishing Acts, Theater Since the 60s. Please help me welcome Gordon Rogoff.
Thanks, Vita, very much for that introduction. I don't think that I can cover the life and the work in 20 minutes or a half hour. So I thought that I would, one of my friends and former students and a colleague who's here, David Balsam, told me to be funny. And I know that that is a direction to an actor that the actor can never do, and in fact it's paralytic, it's paralyzing, so I won't promise to be funny, but I can promise to tell the story so far, but I'll begin it with from a slightly different point of view, at least for myself, which is to give the geographical version of the story, just to cover the geography. It begins with me born in New York and educated at the High School of Music and Art as a high school student, perfectly persuaded that I was a music student until I took a role in a student production, the name of which escapes me now. But what doesn't escape me was that I was cast in precisely the wrong role. A mathematical genius named Slide Rule Hickenlooper. And that touch of realizing something on stage and subsequently discovering that was the identification, my identification. I was no longer myself, I was Slide Rule everywhere I went, and including some years later, standing on a platform of Lausanne station and somebody screaming across to me, "Slide Rule, how are you?" And I thought, I cannot get rid of this role. You could say that the rest of my life was spent trying to shed Slide Rule from my personality. Certainly, I knew the easy part to shed was the mathematical genius, which I have never been. But I did think that I was interested at first in music, and strangely, coming into twilight time, I find myself as much, if not more, interested in music than I am in the drama. That's not going to be very encouraging on this occasion, but I'll try to get to some form of encouragement later on, perhaps. From there, I got into Yale for my undergraduate years, and I studied English literature, which I still feel was the best part of my formal education. And I tend to want to advise young people who are interested in the drama and the theater to not study acting or any of the other disciplines in undergraduate years, but to get themselves the best possible, if you like to call it that, classical education. And from Yale, I graduated on, I think I've got this right, June 9th, 1952. And on June 10th, I took a studentship to Europe. I had to make a great escape. The great escape was actually from my loving but much too ordering father, the classical father who wanted me to become what he wanted me to become. And that was to become, he thought, a professor of English literature. And I decided that's not what I wanted to do, and he never knew that I had turned down a fellowship at the University of Connecticut for a master's degree. He didn't know that I had done that, and he thought I was applying to Harvard, but I didn't. And I instead applied to the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-on-Avon, the University of Birmingham, for a summer there. I knew that he would like that. That was Shakespeare. So I went, but again, I was surreptitious, sneaky. It's a terrible admission, but it's true. I arranged to have an audition for the Central School of Speech and Drama and Acting in London, and once I got there. And to make that story brief, of course, I did get in. I noticed in this exhibition that there's actually some letter narrative to my parents about that, and I thought it was all, mind you, I thought most of this stuff was gone. I didn't know it existed. That's the marvel of the archives here. It really is incredible. And so I studied at the Central School, where I left for the summer, came back to the States at first, and I did summer stock in Milford, Pennsylvania, playing Ensign Pulver and Mr. Roberts. And I think, judging from the pictures, that I wasn't bad, but and certainly it was a lot of fun. But then I was getting roles more or less of a kind that I didn't really feel suited for, where I had to put gray in my hair, all the older roles, and I didn't like that. And we had to build the sets, we had to do everything. And we also had to move our sets from one theater to another through every week in the summer, and rehearse and learn your lines, your sides. Those are the days when actors had sides. They didn't know the whole play, but they knew their part, which I think is actually a rather good exercise. And then I sold Boys Furnishings at Saks Fifth Avenue. This is still back in New York. for two winter seasons. I turned down the offer to become management at Saks Fifth Avenue, and I worked as assistant story editor for the General Electric Theater. And one of my tasks was not only to find stories to dramatize for GE Theater, but to write the introductions for the master of ceremonies named Ronald, at that time Ronald Reagan, that's how we knew him. And we actually met him once, and it was a very limp hand that shook my hand. And then I went back to London because in the Central School, a group of students and myself founded a magazine. We somehow persuaded the student organization to allow us to do this magazine, but we really had ambitions beyond the school itself. It wasn't really going to be a school magazine. And it took several years, really not until the roughly around the time of the great changeover in the manner of British theater at that time, with the Brecht visit to London and Look Back in Anger, the Royal Court Theater, that Kenneth Tynan sort of knighted us with the this is a magazine that anybody interested in the theater has to read. Immediately we had our first 1,000 subscriptions, and we never had more than that. Later, I was delighted to read that the famous, marvelous Edward Gordon Craig, who ran the magazine from Florence in the early part of the century and until 1927, I think it was, he had a subscription list of 1,000. So my message through my life and my message to everybody else now is don't expect more than 1,000 good subscribers for your serious work. Craig's subscribers were people like Thomas Mann and James Joyce, and I thought that was pretty good. And that was the kind of subscriber we were looking for also. And I think we found them too. But I had to come back. I was always economically driven. I had to come back to New York, and New York is my home. And by one strange move from another with people, it's always people you know, I found myself interviewed by Cheryl Crawford, Lee Strasberg, and Elia Kazan for a new job they wanted created. They had no idea what they wanted to call it. They said, if you take it, you have to name, give yourself a title. And I took the title administrative director because I don't think they interviewed anybody else. And again, I think I was as miscast for that as I was for Slide Rule. And so I did stay with them for 2 years, and it was really a formative and important 2 years because I had been so moved by what I knew of their work in the 1930s with the group theater. I thought that is the origin of a possible important American theater, even though it lasted 10 difficult years with disputes amongst all of them that are now well known. And I thought I'd like to be close to that source, and that really was a good reason to be there. I actually did found the director's unit of the studio. I was part of the playwright's unit of the actor's studio with William Hinge and Molly Kazan. And I made one great fatal error at one time. Lee Strasberg was sick one day, and I asked around, I said, what happens when he's sick for one of the sessions? And I was told that the sessions are canceled, and I thought, that's not a good idea. So I called Eli Wallach, actually, who told me this, and I called him, and he said he couldn't do it. He had a commercial to make that day. And then I called Arthur Penn, and Arthur agreed to do it. He didn't know where to sit when he came into the studio, and I said, there, in the director's chair. And that was heresy. And in a sense, it wouldn't be true to accurate to say that Strasberg didn't talk to me after that, but he might as well have stopped altogether because it was the great mistake of a life there that in fact I had to realize I didn't really want. I lasted another year, but not talking to Strasberg. And in a way that was a good thing to do. And I eventually published a piece about Strasberg called Lee Strasberg, Burning Ice. And a familiar figure from this area, Robert Brustein, saw that. And I think he may still be here now, I don't know. And he eventually invited me to join him at the Yale School of Drama, which he was about to, where he's going to become dean in 1966. And I agreed and stayed there for 3 years, after which other geographies, there was Chicago, Columbia College in Chicago, New York State, State University of New York at Buffalo, and then back to New York, always back to New York. Brooklyn College, the Graduate Center, the Cooper Union, and finally again back to New Haven. Richard Gilman asked me to come back to New Haven to the Yale Drama School in a different capacity, this time in the dramaturgy and dramatic criticism position. So that is what I did. I didn't know that I was a dramaturg, but I accepted that as yet another title. In between, in all these other years I was moving around, I was indeed directing plays, mostly with former students, trying to make companies. My great dream was, frankly, to use the academic world to subsidize the art of drama as I saw it. I tried, and I didn't fail, but I certainly didn't sustain it beyond what I was able to do in my way. And with my partner, Morton Lichter, we did as many productions and plays, and back to New York always. That kept happening. But one capacity, it was as bad as my difficulty with mathematics was my difficulty with raising money. And I had no gift for that, and very little gift for self-promotion, too. May not seem that way today, but really in the context of this talk. So I was in dramaturgy, I was in dramatic criticism, and I was writing then for the Village Voice. There was one point in the 70s and the 80s in which I didn't think about it, but I was teaching sometimes six classes a week, because I would go up to New Haven to do one day a week and write for The Voice every week, which meant I had to go to three plays, and then on Fridays write the piece and deliver it to Erica Monk in the offices. That's what you had to do then. You couldn't do it electronically. Come down for a 15-minute edit, and then that was it. It flew out of your hands. You had to let it get published the way it was published. But I liked that very much, but I don't know how I did it. I couldn't, if anybody asked me how to do that sort of thing, I'd say it's quite impossible. I can't do it. So Morton and I have been living in the same rent-controlled apartment on and off, as you can tell, because I'm geographically all over the place, but been keeping that same apartment. Now it's 44 years. We have had, thanks to him, only stone houses, a stone house in the Berkshires for 21 years, I think it was, followed by restoring, which was a crazy, quixotic effort. And I used to say, this is my other theater, restoring a house, a farmhouse in Tuscany. Followed by an already restored house in the west of Ireland, in West Cork. And everybody used to say, why did you leave Tuscany for West Cork? And I said, because I prefer the weather. anyway, all these houses are gone now in other people's hands, and we're back in New York. That's, in a sense, my friend in Ireland said to me the other day, just say the story so far. In directing, well, step back a bit. In December, Moore and I went to see Mark Rylance in Measure for Measure at the St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn, and something came over. It's not exactly an epiphany, but I had to say out loud, I really miss this. I miss directing. I miss making theater. I'm not only what I have become, which is essentially a teacher and a writer who doesn't write enough. But I don't know what to do about that. That's a problem. I'll get to that in a moment, to another version of the same thoughts that are crowding my mind these days. I see there's something, a communication from Terrence McNally to me from the time of the Berkshire Theater Festival. So I directed plays by him, by John Webster, The White Devil, and Bertolt Brecht's Baal. I guess those are my two favorite productions. I did a lot of crazy improvisational things, you could call them, based on Shakespeare. The first one, I say, was a stillborn attempt, also at the Berkshire Theater Festival, called Timon's Beach. And it was meant to be a group piece, because what I've left out of here is my work with the Open Theater and with Joe Chaykin. It was meant to be a group improvised speech in taking off from the last three acts of Timon after he sends himself into exile out of sheer outrage and disgust, and to do a piece that was contemplative, meditative on the subject of exile and banishment. And in Shakespeare you can find, as we did, hundreds and hundreds of lines and phrases and poetic disquisitions on just those subjects. And one of my former students from Yale in the 60s also said to me a few weeks ago, if you want to give advice to students, just give the advice you gave to us. And I said, what was that? And he said, you remember you said there is a world elsewhere. That's Coriolanus. And that was part of Timon's Beach. That said, Timon's Beach didn't satisfy me. I thought it was stillborn. Mort was in it and suffered through it, I think. I don't know if he would confirm that, but there was, after that, I began to think, what would be my ideal world? And it was not lovely of Vitas to say that he dreams in theater. And my dream was a world in which you only were given the words of Shakespeare. That's all you could speak. And so all the works that I created, nobody knows about them because we didn't publicize them, and we were doing them in places like Buffalo, Chicago, and no New Yorkers ever saw them, and therefore you don't exist. So there was Shakespeare Heaven, Son of Shakespeare Heaven, Bride of Shakespeare Heaven, and then maybe my favorite strange work, which was called Venus, From Venus and Adonis, the poem, turning it into a drama, if you could say. It was Venus and Adonis or The Open Road. Those were the days of the Beats, and this was a cast of Beats on, you could say, on motorcycles, all imaginary motorcycles. And then finally, not finally, but eventually, Mort was developing in the University of Buffalo a fascinating, I think, superb work on the difficulties of old age. This long before we are now at the edge of what is called old age, I guess. But it was called Old Timer's Sexual Symphony and Other Notes. And he did the first production, and I stepped in later to direct it, probably because I saw something that could bring me a little glory, and that may have been unfair. I think his work was fine without me, but I did it, and we both copped Obie Awards for that particular thing. That did appear in New York, and also in other cities, in Florence, and in Parma, wasn't it, also? Old-timers, in the opera house, where we were convinced we'd get booed the way most opera singers are booed. But we weren't. And then I did, I was really getting passionate about adaptation, in a way, and I did, and I fell in love with the Italo Calvino, and did some of his stories from Cosmic Comics. I don't know if you know them, but I highly commend them to you. Your attention. And the great undone work, all of us still talk about it, was his Invisible Cities. When I saw Calvino in Rome, shortly as it happened before he died, he said, why do you want to do my work? It's so arcane and poetic. And I said, that's why I want to do your work. And he seemed to like that. He had the Cosmic Comics posters up on his wall, and I thought Invisible Cities, while anti-dramatic, would be just the thing to do. I think it was it's coincidental with the kinds of works that Mort was actually doing and that Robert Wilson, of course, was doing, in which we were not considering ourselves moved by all the Aristotelian so-called necessities. We were not being driven by that. We were allowing time to become master. And of course, the great master of that is Samuel Beckett. And I'm actually currently teaching, again, a course on Samuel Beckett's novels and plays, because I am fascinated by the challenge to stop time, even in the theater. Everybody said, oh, it's good, it was fast, it was well-paced and all that. To me, the best theater might be the 3 minutes that are not well-paced. In other words, that they're just looking at the object and being very quiet and internal. And that's where I think I was there in the beginning, but it took me a long time to be even semi-articulate about it. In the 90s, the great sport has been stage readings, because nobody could produce anything without spending a lot of money. And I did a lot of stage readings, plays of a former student who's a great friend now, Susan Yankowitz. But we never got them on full time. Although I was her dramaturg when she did a play of hers was done by Nikos Sakharopoulos at Williamstown. He called me special dramaturg. I didn't know what was so special about it, except that he banished me and Susan from the theater. So I think that's what he must have meant by it. Amongst my unfulfilled wishes are directing operas. I wish I'd practiced the piano more diligently. And also, I wish I hadn't allowed myself to be intimidated by all the modern drama books by Eric Bentley, Robert Brustein, and Richard Gilman. Thus never producing my own singular volume on modern drama, the one about Ibsen and Chekhov and I've never done that. I have the odd pieces here and there, but never that book. I thought, they've all said it, what can I possibly add? And in a way, that's the way I proceeded, which may not be the best way to proceed. In fact, I'm sure it's not, but those are the choices I made. My greatest disappointments? One may come as a surprise, my 8 years as a chair, department chair in the academic world. Not finishing the biography I began of the director, Luchino Visconti. Never being invited to fail, like almost everybody else, as an artistic director in the regional theater. I would have liked that opportunity. And finally, great disappointment, frankly, is the academic world, especially what it's become, a kind of branch of the corporate world. And that doesn't make me feel comfortable at all. I wished I had seen Maria Callas more than once, but I did see her in an opera. And I wished I had seen Laurette Taylor, who was in the Glass Menagerie. I didn't have to miss it, but I missed it. And I wished I'd seen her. And only a few weeks ago, I discovered that there's footage of her a screen test. So I saw about 1 minute and a half, 90 minutes. And I won't say it's the greatest thing I ever saw. That would be an exaggeration. But it's extremely appealing and a great discovery. It's good to have lived long enough to see that. I want to see more of it. I hope there is more of it. In teaching these days, my favorite classes are teaching Shakespeare, Beckett, Shaw, and opera as drama, although I've more or less given that up because the students coming our way are very intimidated by classical music. They don't know it, they haven't learned it, and it's not appealing. And even though dramaturgs especially could have lots of work in opera, they don't seek to do it. The designers do it with Ming Cho Lee at Yale. They do a lot of opera study, and that's as it should be. Because they certainly get perhaps more work in opera than they get in the standard theater. And then above all, I like teaching writing now. the criticism workshops that Richard Gilman and Stanley Kaufman established at Yale many years ago. And that's what drew me to return to Yale to teach those classes. And there's really desert island choice. That's what I want to do more than anything else. Anywhere. I'd come anywhere to teach writing at this point. My present obsession, and I'm getting not far enough with it at all, is a book that already has its title taken from Henry James' observation of Ibsen's play John Gabriel Borkman, in which he described the play as being sunset over ice. And I am doing this as a working title for a book that is about late works by several artists, not just playwrights by any means. So the five chosen at the moment are Verdi, mainly for Falstaff, Ibsen, more for Borkman than When We Dead Awaken, but we'll see. I don't know how that will turn out. Henri Matisse, that's a challenge to me. I don't know that I can really write about painting, but I want to try. Mort Lichter is a painter, so I'm close to it, but at the same time, do I have the language for it? I don't know. Ingmar Bergman's late works on the stage and screen, and inevitably Richard Strauss, because of Capriccio, the four last songs, the fifth last song, which was published about 20 years ago, finally, and the great chamber work, Metamorphosen, which I find, well, one is always choosing music for one's funeral, and that might work, but it's a little long, as I have tended to be this evening. And that's the story. There is never enough time. There's never enough money. And the story goes on. Teaching Beckett, usually you're supposed to emphasize all the profundities, so-called, and all the background. He thought it was a load of old rubbish, all of that exegesis and interpretation. And he tended to call it, if I have the right thing, all of that sort of critical stuff, headaches through the overtones. But the great quotation from Beckett this semester for me is the one in where he told his friend Francis Stewart, a writer, "My life is filled with trivia." And I thought, well, if Beckett can confess that, so can I. So that's what I would say so far anyway about life and work. The story goes on, of course. Beckett did say to John Montague, at least Montague claims he said it, when he came to see him in Paris, when he really, what was his last year, and they had a drink together. Beckett drank a lot, you know, not as an alcoholic, I promise you, but he loved his whiskey. And he said, in parting from John, he said, "If I fall down, don't pick me up." So I'd say the same. Thanks very much.
I want to thank you all for turning out in such great numbers. It's wonderful to be here with you all tonight and to start this discussion. To introduce myself, I'm Jim Petosa, director here at BU of our School of Theater. I also function professionally as an artistic director of the Olney Theater Center in metropolitan Washington, D.C. area. So most of my curiosities come from the synergy that exists between the professional theater and the academic theater. I also want to let each panelists do a brief introduction of themselves so you get a sense of the diversity of opinion, experience, and approach from each of this terrific group of people. So Will, if you would start us off.
Good evening, I'm Will Lyman. I'm an actor and a narrator and a sometime filmmaker. And, I've lived here in Boston ever since I went to Boston University. have traveled extensively, but make my home here because we love this city.
Hello, I'm Paula Langton. I am the head of the acting program at Boston University. And I am also currently working as an actor in this town with the new company in town called Actors Shakespeare Project.
My name is Michael Masso. I'm the managing director of the Huntington Theater Company, which seems to be a place that I'm going to be the rest of my life. So.
Good.
My name is Rob Orchard, and I'm the other bad penny in town across the river at the American Repertory Theater. I've been with the organization since it was founded in 1980, and it's a great privilege to be doing theater in this community with such fabulous energy and intelligence, and I hope I'll continue to be able to do so for many years to come.
Hi, I'm Paula Plum, and I'm an actress and a director and a writer. I graduated from Boston University a little bit behind Will Lyman, and I'm with Paul Langton in the Actors Shakespeare Project, and I'm very happy to be here tonight.
I'm Kate Snodgrass. I'm artistic director at Boston Playwrights Theater, which is just up the street. We're in the creative writing department, of which I am a graduate of Boston University. I work with Derek Walcott, our Nobel Prize winner, and we do only new works for the stage. We have two black box theaters over there, and we do only new works. I'm also a playwright, a former actor and director, but now I write plays and I produce them.
Thank you all. Our topic, the future of the American theater, is certainly a grand one to wrap your brain around. I think it's safe to say that we're probably living in a time where the challenges that we are facing were not all of that predictable to us, or at least I can speak for myself on that. I didn't think 20 years ago that this would be the place that we would find ourselves asking questions about what the future of American theater would be like. So in preparation for this, and to give our conversation a degree of a spine to it, I want to share an excerpt with you, and also to give the panel something to respond to. It's a Washington Post article. Philip Kinnicutt, a frequent columnist and often arts writer for the Washington Post, reporting on this year's Nancy Hanks lecture. And it was quite a surprise to find out that this year's guest speaker was William Safire, a pretty noted conservative pundit, intelligent man, but not the person you would expect to be invited to give this kind of a statement. Kennicott writes, "It used to be fairly easy to draw the political battle lines over art in America. On one side, let's call it the left, was a view of human creativity that emphasized confrontation and paradigm busting, that reveled in political provocation and performance art, experimental theater and German opera directors. On the other hand, let's call it the right, was a view of art as affirmative and pretty, that favored arts that were popular enough to be commercial, and most of the traditional performing arts, and could be found on a nightly basis at places like the Kennedy Center. This basic cultural fissure was only deepened by the right-wing assault on the National Endowment for the Arts in the early 90s, and the failed left-wing efforts to push back with yet more provocation and confrontation." I think it's a very concise and interesting way to kind of look at where we are. He goes on now talking about what Safire had to say. "Safire acknowledged for himself the intrinsic value of art and used words such as enrich and treasure and timeless, buzzwords all for the intrinsic position. The thrust of Safire's talk was really about the art's instrumental value. And that now seems to be the mainstream view, that art is instrumental in a pragmatic way, that it is good for making children better at other more useful things, like math and reading, which everyone values. There is also a view of art as instrumentally radical, meaning it helps people question assumptions and challenge authority, but that view is now quietly encased in the past in movies like Dead Poets Society. Among those listening to Sapphire were no doubt some instrumental liberals, but in hopes of reviving art in the public sphere, many of them seem to have thrown in their lot with the instrumental conservatives. Any responses?
I just think it's sad to think of art as an instrument for anything but itself. I mean, we're talking about theater right now, and theater should be an expression of the deepest taboos and the deepest anguishes and the deepest sorrows and the deepest joys, and provide catharsis for the audience because it expresses those things, not because it makes us better at doing other things.
It's interesting, this notion of instrumental value. It's something that our culture has faced for generations, going back to Tocqueville. But it's also curious, just coincidentally, I was writing in my diary, I asked the question, how can theater endure in a culture where whatever cannot be measured is not valued, where what cannot be predicted will not be risked, and where whatever can't deliver a forecast outcome is not undertaken? And these, of course, are all values that can be applied very effectively to any number of enterprises in our culture. But all of these values, of course, are characteristic of great art. I mean, great art is never measurable, it's never predictable, and it's always the result of some level of risk. So we will always fail every economic measure. And I say we should do so triumphantly.
Joyfully, yes.
Well, it is a question of is it not of the value, whose values and who's the driving force in saying what the value is? And as we head into the great American century of American feudalism, I think we need to pay very close attention to this, that when Mr. Sapphire talks about children being educated to become more productive, this is a viewpoint that comes from, this is an economic viewpoint. This is a commercial viewpoint. This is a point of view that of a machine that wishes to bring people into its factories, that wishes to bring people into its productive cycle to keep itself growing. This has nothing to do with the individual. This has nothing to do with who we are, which is the basis of art. And it's not a teaching process from the standpoint of somebody saying, you have a lesson to learn, and I'm going to tell you what it is. Because that's the most evil kind of education that there is, in my mind. So the value of the art that the theater brings is something that hopefully is not necessarily pretty, as Mr. Rogoff says, it's dangerous. It is dangerous. It has to be dangerous. That's where we live. We live on that dangerous edge.
Since arts policy is definitely a secondary concern for most Americans, education policy is a primary factor. And I think for parents, the concern for the quality of education their students receive is now very caught up in quantitative analysis. So a parent is probably more concerned about SAT scores than they are necessarily about a more intuitive-based education. Why? Because the choices their children are going to have in the future are going to be more impacted by standardized testing results than the quality of person. So if you're making an argument about academic programs that have arts education in it has been found to increase SAT scores by 100 points, that becomes the value of the arts program. I think the arts debate is just a segment of a much larger discussion to be had about the education of our children and what that means and how we participate in that.
Why do we think that's more important? It's because we've got a whole structure that continues to tell us that that's what's important.
That's correct. Yeah. So perhaps one of our answers about this question of the future is the artists themselves, we have to be willing to come out of the closet with our convictions for the intrinsic value of what we do, instead of co-opting arguments that are going to get us funding dollars, appeal to government grants, that we've got to stop playing the game and speak passionately about what our beliefs really are. And I wonder if we have done that.
Let me argue a bit.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
So, and my argument is really about why is it that we have to tell people what value they should get out of it? I mean, it seems to me there's this enormous range of value that people get from their exposure to the arts. We all strive for the genius, for the work of genius, for exposure to that person or group of people who is a genius. And we get this enormous layer of deep meaning out of the genius. Most of us don't see the genius every day. Then there is that range from perhaps something you might not like or I might not like to the notion of genius. And it seems to me there are values that come out of that. And I'm serious. If Sapphire feels that there are values inherent in the theater, maybe he's taking the same values that I would, and maybe he's taking totally different values. But he's taking value out of this process that may not be the value that those of us who work in the theater are striving for. I don't see why those two notions can't coexist. I don't see why one is mutually exclusive to the other, or that, in fact, even that it's dangerous. Unless what we want is a society which totally understands the nature of genius and celebrates us for working towards it. And I don't think that's a society that I'm going to see in this world. And so I guess I think that we can allow people that range of reaction, and while the question is as individuals, what is it that we get out of observing a work of art? And that's the same as somebody may look at a Monet and only see pretty. Pretty ain't bad. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that's all that's there. Right. That doesn't mean they're correct in terms that they have really plumbed the depths of the Monet, but I don't want to tell them they're wrong.
No, and I don't think it's a matter of right or wrong, and I do think we get a little too caught up on this notion of what do we like and what don't we like, and so we already come in predetermined with what our taste is, and I think what theaters can do a better job at is helping audiences understand the pleasures of experiences that they may not think they're going to like and discover they do have a taste for it. I mean, the phrase I've often used is there is a pleasure to provocation, and allowing an audience to experience that a good provocative time can be quite entertaining and not merely in your face in a way that's going to alienate. And we can help them with that. You do that all the time.
Alienation is a good thing, too.
It is. How about from a writer?
I can only talk about what we, I think it's so complicated what we're talking about. The stimulus response to all of these just, it goes, it's a cone. And it starts here and goes out, and there's so many things to think about what we should be doing. But I know that, what we're trying to do, what I try to do, at least as a producer, is to pick plays that have a wide range of, that I think have a wide range of response that's going, and it also, of course, depends on what people hand me. But I think my point of view about plays is that sometimes I want to laugh, and sometimes I want to be unnerved, and sometimes I want to cry. And so I try to, as best I can over the course of 2 or 3 years, give our audiences as much of that as possible, and hopefully pull people in, and they can discover a new response to something that they were, didn't know they were going to respond that way. So I totally, that's what I want to do. I don't always succeed, but I know that I try not to choose plays that are easy, that I feel, you know, this is another thing, that one thing that some of what we're going through now in the theater is the commercialism, and many, you know, the spectacle can pull an audience in, and that money can pull an audience in, but will it give them the story that's going to pull them into the theater, or make them actually feel something and think something? Sometimes not. And that's unnerving to me. So I'm worried about that end of it, the whole commercial pull, and playwrights are being pulled into it as well. And it makes it easy on an audience, and that for me is anathema.
I think it's true, though, what you said about, from a public policy perspective, that we haven't, as a country, made a case for the arts. There isn't animating, overarching case for the arts in this country as there is in other countries. And so we have to fall back on the language of measurability, of instrumentality, so that we're still around at a point when we're capable of making the case perhaps more cogently. So we do get caught in these inevitable conflicts between our souls and what we think from a purist point of view we would like everybody to believe, and the need to survive.
Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to a lecture and panel discussion presented by the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center at Boston University. The main speaker was distinguished theater critic Gordon Rogoff. Following Mr. Rogoff's lecture was a panel discussion on The Future of the Theater, featuring actor and narrator Will Lyman, Boston University School of Theater Assistant Professor Paula Langton, Huntington Theater Company Executive Director Michael Masso, American Repertory Theater Company Executive Director Rob Orchard, actress, director, and writer Paula Plum, and Boston Playwrights Theater Artistic Director Kate Snodgrass. School of Theater Director Professor Jim Petosa moderated the discussion. We began with an introduction by Managing Director of the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center, Vita Palladino. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.
From Boston University, this is 1290 WRNI Providence.